Well, it's a pleasure to get a chance to speak with you, and we're looking forward to seeing you quite often in the Valley pretty soon.
Oh, my pleasure as well. Very honored to be invited to participate at the Red Rocks Music Festival already for the fourth time.
The fourth time.
It's really an honor to be invited to this festival, and it's my privilege to have collaborated with the executive director and founder, Moshe Buchspan. So I really admire his vision and how he has grown the festival and how he has developed the base of the audience and educational opportunities and longevity for this festival and steady support for it.
There are, for most of us, the idea of being a principal violinist in some of the orchestras. You've been like the Metropolitan, the first woman at the Metropolitan Opera.
Still to this day, because they just hired a new man concertmaster. So in the foreseeable future, I still remain the only female concertmaster in the history of the Metropolitan Opera.
But I think you can see where I'm going. For some people, that's the career. For other people, it's the concert stage. For other people, it's chamber music as their career. But you do it all, and it's remarkable to me that you've been able to do that and be so successful with it.
I pride myself on that, the eclectic path my career has taken, and everything has been very fortunate for me. Orchestral career and chamber music, recording career. I'm Grammy nominated, and I'm every year recording more and more recording projects and trying to be very diverse with everything that I record. So proud to have had collaborations with many, many great musicians. And many of my collaborations ventured in unexpected directions. But I'm very, very happy, and I consider myself fortunate to be able to do all this. And I love it. I don't just specialize in one particular niche, like Baroque or classical or romantic. I'm very happy to do everything that I can for all composers and all styles.
Well, it's a pleasure to get a chance to speak with you, and we're looking forward to seeing you quite often in the Valley pretty soon.
Oh, my pleasure as well. Very honored to be invited to participate at the Red Rocks Music Festival already for the fourth time.
The fourth time.
This year is my fourth time I'm participating, yes.
Well, this time it looks like you're exploring some repertoire that we don't often think of. If I'm reading this correctly, it's works for violin and horn.
That's right, in a program under the title Music from Five Centuries. It's really an honor to be invited to this festival, and it's my privilege to have collaborated with the executive director and founder, Moshe Buchspan, and with the artistic director, David Ehrlich, of the festival. So as I said, already this year is my fourth time, and previously I have also been very happy with my participation at the Red Rocks Music Festival, because I'm happy to witness how the executive director and founder Moshe Buchspan has actually realized his vision to grow the Red Rocks Music Festival into a major cultural event, not only on the Arizona level, but on a national and international level, with the participation of stellar artists every year and very fascinating repertoire, and also with great educational opportunities with the Chamber Music Institute that is attached now to the festival. And as I said, due to this vision that he has steadily developed and established during the years of existence of his festival, we are able to bring great programs with unusual repertoire, and we are really, really happy about that. It allows us, the artists, to also realize our visions of programs that we desire to bring, and that's terrific. So I really admire his vision and how he has grown the festival and how he has developed the base of the audience and educational opportunities and longevity for this festival and steady support for it.
It's nice to have you say that, because I remember when Moshe called me, I can't remember how many years ago now, and told me he planned to do this. And I thought, man, you know, good luck. Other people have tried, but Moshe has seen it through. And but it's nice when the artist and someone of your caliber can say, this is really fantastic, and hats off to Moshe.
It is. It is fantastic. And for myself, with my fourth time of participating this year, it's just one other stellar opportunity to participate, as well as my collaborator Howard Wall. That's his second time participating. Several years ago, he and I were participants in a program, Brahms and Friends, in Phoenix and Sedona. And so it's to be re-invited and to be participating, it's a privilege and honor, and we just really thrive on that. And artistically and individually, it feeds our souls and our artistic aspirations. So, well, we are happy about that.
When you say that, it means even more than when other people might say that, because of the different things you've done in music as a violinist. There are, for most of us, the idea of being a principal violinist in some of the orchestras you've been, like the Metropolitan, the first woman at the Metropolitan Opera.
Yes, still to this day, because they just hired a new man concertmaster. So in the foreseeable future, I still remain the only female concertmaster in the history of the Metropolitan Opera.
But I think you can see where I'm going. For some people, that's the career. For other people, it's the concert stage. For other people, it's chamber music as their career, or doing some of the more, well, creative programming you've done. But you do it all, and it's remarkable to me that you've been able to do that and be so successful with it. Was it your goal as a child? I mean, I know you started playing when you were very young. When did you know that the violin was what you wanted to do?
Initially, I really hadn't known. It was my father who decided it for me. And so since the age of three, none of us remembers what we knew at the age of three, of course. But since the age of three, I have had a violin in my hands. And already at the age of four, I was concertizing. My first concert was, first recital was at the age of four. And since then, the years have grown. The years have gone so fast. I can't believe how many things have happened and how brief and fleeting everything is. So, as you said, I'm trying to do a lot of things, and I'm trying to be very eclectic. And I even pride myself on that, the eclectic path my career has taken. And everything has been very fortunate for me, orchestral career and chamber music, recording career. I'm Grammy nominated, and I'm every year recording more and more recording projects, and trying to be very diverse with everything that I record. So proud to have had collaborations with many, many great musicians, such as the double bassist of the planet, number one in the planet, Gary Carr, and many others. The world-renowned French pianist Pascal Roger comes to mind, with whom I performed and recorded music by Poulenc. Other recording projects we have done very well as well. In 2015, last year, one of my recordings was named Record of the Year by the very prestigious publication Music Web International. That was in world premieres of very little-known composer, French composer by the name of René de Castera. It was a discovery, this recording, for a lot of music lovers who had not even known this composer. And just yesterday, I came back from the Bard Festival, where I performed the other rare repertoire by the Italian composer Franco Alfano, also forgotten, also neglected, but he actually had a major role in the music world, because he was the one who finished Puccini's opera Turandot. Mm. And after the death of Puccini. And the Bard Festival just had a great idea to call their topic for the festival this year, Puccini and His World. And so this Franco Alfano, who finished Puccini's Turandot, was, of course, part of that. And I was able to perform rare repertoire by Alfano, which I had recorded several years for Naxos. So many of the projects that I do are by rare works by neglected and forgotten composers. And many of my collaborations ventured in unexpected directions. But I'm very, very happy, and I consider myself fortunate to be able to do all this, and I love it. I don't just specialize in one particular niche like Baroque or classical or romantic. I'm very happy to do everything that I can for all composers and all styles. So really, this is tremendous opportunity that includes this festival, the Red Rock Music Festival, of which I personally am very fond, and hope to continue collaborating with this festival and the stellar artistic director and executive director who bring all this great music and great artists to Arizona.
One of the collaborations you've had was, and one I don't think, even with all the variety you've done, I'm not sure anybody would have seen it coming. And how did it come about? Because you'll be back playing with Amjad Ali Khan. When did that begin?
That's a newish thing, newish wrinkle. Just not even 2 years old yet, that aspect. So I was in India performing for a humanitarian cause to end violence against women. That was called the Scheherazade Initiative, and I was performing a classical recital of classical music. And so I met there the world-renowned masters of the sarod, Amjad Ali Khan and his two sons, Ayan and Aman, and we immediately had a sparkling collaborative impulses between us, and made decisions to collaborate based on how they saw me and how I saw them, and the mutual admiration and the mutual considerations that came into mind. The bridge of diverse cultures that we considered, that immediately was realized with already two recordings and a third one in the works of interesting arrangements for sarod and violin. These are the compositions of the terrific, great master of the sarod, Amjad Ali Khan, who is so revered on the entire globe, not just in India, not just in Eastern cultures, but he is universally recognized and admired. He is the equivalent of Ravi Shankar. Ravi Shankar was the godfather of this kind of music with his instrument, sitar. And so is Amjad Ali Khan, who is with his instrument, his own instrument, sarod. He is the greatest living exponent of this instrument. And he and his sons, they are the seventh generation of unbroken generation of that school, of that instrument. And the ragas that he composed and that he arranges in these very interesting collaborations, specifically the one that he did for the collaboration between us, violin and sarod. This is something which feeds off the tradition, the great tradition 50 years ago, which Ravi Shankar and Yehudi Menuhin strived for. And now on a new level, we take off and go even further into this direction, providing very interesting perspectives and a future for this music. And this is not just fusion. This is a lot different. The concept of this is how we stand on the platforms of who we are, actually, without ceding any ground, without becoming different. I don't really perform in the Hindustani style. I perform in my classical tradition in which I have schooled, and they, with their sarods, do the same on their own level. They perform in the way and in the style that they have been schooled. But the juxtaposition of these two very diverse styles and traditions of performing is what makes this collaboration possible and fascinating. So the blending of the two cultures and the different traditions, the East and the West, the meeting between the East and the West is on a level that is truly, to me, is fascinating. I'm very happy to be part of this. And as I said, two CDs recorded already, released on the Feto label, distributed by Naxos, and also released in India on a label that is owned by the greatest newspaper in India, the Times of India. They own a label called Times Music, and that label also released in India and on the Indian subcontinent, which encompasses several countries, not just India. So they did that as well. So we are released globally with this project and are doing very well with this. A third recording project is in the plans soon in October. In the meantime, going in October in India, that will be my fourth trip to India for performing and recording in just a year and a half. And I am just dazed by how quickly all this went and happened. And why it happened, and the reason why it's happening to me and to my career and to everything that I contemplate is because I just am very enthusiastic about everything that I do, and I don't let anything slip by, and I grab every opportunity for interesting repertoire and terrific collaborations, and I revel in all this. And I just intend to do it until I can, because I believe this is my mission and this is what I can contribute humbly.
With what you've just said and my initial question, let me ask again. When you're in India and you're discovering, how much did you know about the Sarod? How much did you know about the ragas? How familiar were you with their tradition?
I have to tell you that I have to confess that I was truly a novice in all this. And now in hindsight, when I do explore and read about it and consider myself already specializing in this a little bit. Now I'm fascinated with what was before and how this all was discovered. And I just recently read Stokowski's book, Music for All of Us, and I can see that Stokowski, a century ago, knew so much about India and Indian culture. And in this particular book of his, he's describing exactly what I am now only discovering, only now finding out. He's describing the ragas and the instruments and how they are played and what they represent and the philosophy behind this whole fascinating thing. So I really knew nothing much about this. I had been immersed mainly in the Western music culture. I had been schooled and working in it. And now that I can see how much more and how complex everything in the Indian classical music and Indian musical traditions is, it boggles the mind how complex everything is, and the ragas and the philosophy behind them, and the healing qualities that this music actually has, bringing somebody to trance and elevating them from their misery or from their pain or from their poverty. That's also a very major aspect of music making in India and a very noble cause. And of course, we all bring beauty, and we all, when we play our concerts, we elevate people with our Brahms and Mozart and everything. But maybe the level to which people, musicians in India, go with their healing abilities, it's even greater help to people there, because when somebody comes to my concert, they have bought a ticket to hear me play Brahms and Mozart, and yes, they are elevated, but are they really healed from their agony or misery? So what I'm saying is that with the Indian ragas and with the function, healing function that music performs on a huge part of the population and of the globe and huge territory, that's even something that we might not suspect much about or not know about. And I am just only now finding out all this, and just I am absolutely fascinated with this.
It's that perspective shift going from the Western tradition that you and I are familiar with, and then you become introduced to this, you immersed in it, and having to say this is a different kind of experience. But it's not only the audience, but the players themselves. You all are in an altered state, and there's a lot of improvisation that happens, and everyone's moving as one. And
yes.
I'm wondering what that's like for you as the skilled player, used to having the Wagner score in front of you, or the Brahms, or the trio you're playing. That now we've got an idea, and we have an outline, and let's just see where we go. What's that like?
Okay, for me, it's a slightly different experience with performing with my illustrious Indian colleagues, because I don't actually improvise. I have my music written out for me. And they are the ones improvising. As I said, their seventh generation unbroken tradition of their instruments. They have learned all this by the knees of their fathers and grandfathers. And their tradition, their musical tradition is not necessarily written out. They don't necessarily have a score, although they do in a different aspect. Differently they deal with it. But for me, it has to be written out. Our classical tradition of classical music and our schooling and our schools and what we learn from our teachers so deprives us from the opportunity to develop as improvisers. You won't believe that. And it's too bad that we become a little stunted in this respect, because striving all the time to interpret and to delve into the intentions of the composer, to find out more and more and more about what the composer wants to tell us, it just deprives us of our own voice. We become the voice of the composer. We have to interpret so closely all the dynamics, all the markings, all the phrasing instructions, that we lose the confidence of being our own voice or improvising. And so this is so for a lot of my colleagues in classical music and Western tradition. We have shared this frustration many times between ourselves. And so being out of my zone of comfort with this new experience for me, playing Indian ragas and trying to collaborate with Sarod, which is already difficult to balance, difficult enough. So being out of my zone of comfort, I really need to have it written out, and that's what Amjad Ali Khan did. He actually is a absolute genius, and these pieces are masterpieces that he composed. If you hear some of my recorded material for that, or if you come to the concert, you'll discover that the violin solos that Amjad Ali Khan wrote for me, taken by themselves, played by just heard on their own, they sound almost like Bach and like Baroque music. That's how they evolve. That's how they unfold, those solos. They're complex solos in the style of sounding almost like Baroque music, but they so seamlessly blend with the specific raga and the specific tonalities and specific modes that the ragas prescribe and that the ragas require. So it's just mind-boggling how this all happens. And in that respect, Amjad Ali Khan is a genius on a par with all the greatest Western composers. What comes out and what the result is no less beautiful, no less complex, no less fascinating than anything that was written by Beethoven or Brahms. And I stand behind my words here.
It's interesting. This is a concert being put on and for the benefit of TGen, the Genomics Research Institute here in the Valley. And just kind of the mystery you're talking about, you know, the 21st century, one of the mysteries is all that we're doing with genomics and all the research that's going on. And it's even a little bit more magical, too, about that. We've spoken for a long time, and I don't want to keep you terribly long, but there are a couple of things I want to make sure I ask you because I have you on the phone. One is, in looking over your bio on your webpage, it mentioned Carlos Kleiber, and I have to ask, what was it like to work with him?
Oh, this was just one of the highlights of my entire career, not just my operatic career, because Carlos Kleiber was a stellar event on his own, by himself, and there has been nobody like him, and many colleagues of mine consider themselves to have been lucky to perform with him under his baton. The Metropolitan Opera Orchestra was his favorite orchestra in America, actually. He said that on many occasions, that he experienced the greatest pleasure of collaborating with our orchestra, with the Metropolitan Opera. And the several productions that he conducted and the several opportunities that this afforded us to experience him and to be so close to him and to be touched by his magnificent musicality, this was just an incomparable opportunity. So I will forever cherish these magic moments. And in particular, I just won't forget rehearsing and performing Rosenkavalier under him. And this was just something.
I can only imagine Richard Strauss, the Rosenkavalier. Oh, gosh, that must have been remarkable. It seems to those of us who don't have a chance to do what you did, and that's to work with him, but you observe maybe a rehearsal or you see a live performance, there are those that have been recorded. And it seems that he's the conductor who can so efficiently convey, if only through a glance or through his hands, not with a lot of words, it doesn't seem like, what he sees is going to happen in this performance. He has obviously a clear idea of what he wants, but it's almost improvisational in the sense that if he sees something happening, it almost, perhaps not in opera, but in an orchestra performance, it was almost as though, well, if we're going to try that, that's cool, let's try that. Was there any of that collaborative stuff with him at all in performance? Or was it pretty much absolute? No, this is what I said we're going to do.
Well, I have to say that the magic that he created somehow in unknown channels, unknown ways, it was happening in spite of everything, in spite of us, in spite of him. It was almost some cerebral force, some hypnotizing power. And a lot of people felt that way. So it's hard to analyze why it happened and how. And many people have said in the past that maybe von Karajan also had the same powers, and something in the fluidity of the wrist movements and the hand gestures, something was just connecting on a subconscious level, hypnotizing. And so it's hard to say, and nobody has been able to find out exactly how this happened, but it happened, and it was beyond anything, beyond words, the magic that happened. Not so much talking, not so much analyzing during rehearsals. It was just the power of the choreographed or possibly non-choreographed movements of his wrists and hands and his eyes closed or open, and how they commanded us to behave or play. Those things are never analyzed, and nobody knows.
Yeah. There was something else I saw, and it intrigued me. Having played the violin, it's an instrument that a lot of people aren't familiar with. So along with your classical, your beautiful instruments, you have something that's sort of half trumpet, half violin.
Oh yes.
When did you get a hold of a Stroh violin? How did that happen?
Well, this was a recording project that has not been released yet, and it's only halfway happened. It's called Souvenirs d'Isaïe. It's about a great Eugène Isaïe, the great violinist and composer. One of the gods of violin, I would say. So this is a project that this instrument was considered for. And the specific piece, though, has not been recorded yet. And I'm only trying to get comfortable with this instrument. But the Stroh violin was in heavy use in the dawn of the recording era. And when the amplification of the weakly sounding then in violin and string instruments was something which was hindering and preventing the sound production during recording. So they needed something to make the violin project better. So that funnel that it's almost like a trumpet, part of a trumpet that extends out of the Stroh violin, that was helping then in the recording process in the dawn of the recording era, the first recordings, that was helping. But it also was making the instrument sound very strange, very strange. So I went to some old recordings that are now existing on YouTube to try and to see and to compare. And just the very sound of this is really foreign and takes some getting used to. And how I'm going to integrate that with a piece which is being composed for this project, which I will be performing on the Stroh violin. The piece is by the composer and recording producer Jean Godet, with whom I collaborate closely on his label Urlicht Audiovisual. And we're waiting for him to finish the piece so that I could start practicing it. And I'm kind of almost dreading it, because this violin is very heavy, very, very heavy, with the metal parts that it involves. It's heavy to hold, heavy to operate.
And it just seems awkward, too. I mean, you look at it, there's like a rod going down the center and this bell hanging off the side.
Exactly. So as much as I'm looking forward to the piece and forward to the recording project, I I am still uncomfortable with the instrument, still trying to see how I will make it work. And it's a challenging thing, but I'm looking forward to see what the result will be. So it's just another aspect of finding out new things.
Last question I have to ask, because it's a habit I have over the years when I speak with a violinist. Everyone talks about the instrument you play. We've mentioned the Stroh. I know you have some remarkable instruments. But I always like to know, have you found your bow, and when did you find it? Or are you still looking for that bow that's Elmira's?
Oh, well, I found it about 20 years ago. And my favorite bow was made by the late great cellist, Jerry Kagan, who was my colleague and friend from the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra. He was also a bow maker and a very, very good one. So he was making a bow for me, and I was not happy because I was looking for something heavy. Heavy bows is my preference. So I tried several of his bows, and I was not going to have them, really not happy. So at the end, he just said to me, final try with me was, he said, well, I'm making a viola bow. It's on the heavy side. Why don't you try it? Instead of making it a viola bow, maybe I can modify it into a violin bow. And it's 65 grams heavy, which doesn't sound like anything to the untrained ear when I say 65 grams. And my Mozart bow is 57 grams. And just that one 8-gram difference is a big difference to anybody's fingers and to my fingers. With my preference for heavy bows, I just fell in love with that one bow that he was making for viola bow. And so as soon as I tried it, I said, Jerry, please make it into a violin bow. And that was it. And I've had this bow. It's my most preferred bow. And I play it almost all the time, except when I play Mozart, for which a heavy bow would be hindering the phrasing and the fleeting staccato or any light, transparent phrasing. So that is it. It's Jerry Kagan's bow. And he is not forgotten. He's missed as a musician and a bow maker. The Strad magazine had an article about him several years ago. Well, we miss him.
I'm so glad I asked. That's such a magical story. And now I know, and we'll be able to share with others too.
Thank you for asking.
Well, and thank you for coming. We'll be looking forward to seeing you a little later this month, and then at the TGen with the Amjad Ali Khan and his sons too. All four of you will be performing?
I believe it's only Ayan and Amjad Ali Khan and his son Ayan and myself. So this is a benefit concert actually for a medical cause, and it's happening on September 3rd at the Tempe Center for the Arts. So it will be my second trip to Arizona, and I'm just going to only, because I have to travel to Italy on the next day, so I will only arrive on September 3rd, perform the concert, and leave immediately after the concert at 11:59 p.m. that night because I will have to go to Italy, perform there the next day. But I was able to confirm that I could participate in this concert, and I'm happy about coming to Arizona twice in September for this, in August and September.
Yeah, well, we're glad you're able to touch down and to touch base. I've really enjoyed speaking with you, and thank you for all you're doing. Continued luck with all your endeavors, and thank you again.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure speaking to you.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.